Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Accountability and transparency are two important words for journalists, particularly when it comes to the government. Beyond the First Amendment, there are laws at the state and federal level aimed to increase governmental accountability and transparency. But what's the situation really like? How difficult is it for journalists to get the information they need? And what reasons do government officials give for keeping some information private? Today on Intersection, we'll find out how transparent our state really is. We'll also talk about ways people access government records in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio, Bob Priddy is the news director at MissouriNet, which specializes in covering the state government. He's been the news director there for nearly 40 years. Thanks for being here, Bob.
Thank you.
Judd Slivka is the former communications director of the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. In that role, he served as the liaison between the public and that department. Before that, he worked as a journalist for about 10 years and will join the faculty at the University of Missouri School of Journalism this fall. Welcome to the show, Judd.
Thanks for having me.
And Charles Davis is a professor in the Missouri School of Journalism. His research is focused on access to government and media law. He's also the co-author of the book, The Art of Access, Practical Strategies for Acquiring Public Records. Thanks for being here, Charles.
My pleasure.
All right. And we'd love to hear from you and our audience as well. Do you think Missouri's government is transparent? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you could join our online chat. And I think that's a good question to start you all off with as well, is the state of Missouri's government. How open is the state government in Missouri at the moment, Bob?
It varies, I think, from department to department or division to division. Some divisions are very open. Some divisions are very easy to access and talk to people. Some divisions are very difficult. And for that matter, some particularly executive agency offices are almost impossible to get through sometimes.
And so in what ways are they difficult to get through? How do you get in contact with people when you're calling them?
My biggest problem is finding somebody who has the expertise to talk to me and the credentials to give credence to the story, to the information I'm getting. Too often I have people in the way who decide that they're going to be the spokesman for the whole agency, although they might lack the expertise of the particular questions I ask. And that has grown in the last 15 years or so, and it's an unfortunate trend, and it's a bad trend.
So instead of getting to someone who may be an expert with this particular information, you're talking to a spokesperson or something like that?
Yeah, exactly right. And some agencies, the best PR people in the agencies are the ones who say, I'll have somebody call you back, or this is a person you need to talk to, and I'll patch you through to them. Those are the ones that I welcome the most. The ones that I have the most trouble with are the ones who say, well, I'm the spokesperson, so I can answer all your questions. And too often I have questions where somebody says, I'll have to find out and get back to you. And they'll find out by talking to the person that I should be talking to begin with. That's really aggravating.
So I guess, could you expand on that a little bit, some of those anecdotes on how those things really happen, I guess, and what kind of information are you asking for when that happens?
Well, for example, let me just give you an example. I called the Secretary of State's office last fall. This was when Robin Carnahan was still in, and she had a series of communications directors. And I had an elections question because I had been looking at the Secretary of State's webpage, and already there were several petitions that had come in, or potential petitions, and they listed them as a blue copy and a yellow copy. I couldn't figure out what that was all about. So I called the elections office, and I identified myself and said, I have a question about your listing of petitions. And they said, hang on just a minute. And the next person who came on the line was a communications director. And so I said, what's the deal on the blue and the yellow versions here? And she said, I don't know. I'll have to call the elections division, which is where I started out to begin with.
Right.
And so she said she'd call me back, and it was about 45 minutes before she called me back to answer a simple question. Now, had I called the elections division and not said I was from the media, somebody would have probably told me right then and there. That's the kind of thing that just irritates the socks off of a reporter. And it's the kind of thing that has led me to shall we say, be firm with some people from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and maybe Charles, that's a good time to bring you into the conversation on what are some of the best approaches for journalists on trying to get through some of these walls, I guess. You mentioned that in your book as well, but what are some of the tactics? Is it the old, you attract more flies with honey than vinegar, or is that really true in trying to get through in government agencies?
Well, yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time working with reporters, both student reporters and reporters in the field on access requests. And access requests are sort of a broad way of saying documents, but also what Bob was talking about, which is just gaining access to people and sources within agencies. And he's absolutely right, both at the state level and even more, I think even more pronouncedly at the federal level, you've got this control taking place in which I like to call them Saddam era minders, are put in touch with reporters and literally walk them through federal agencies. I don't think the state is nearly as bad as the feds are at this, but reporters who have requests to talk to scientists at the Centers for Disease Control, for example, who are not working in safe houses, by the way, who are in just administrative offices, and they are not physically allowed to go sit down and talk to a source without a minder with them. This is stuff out of repressive regimes around the world that we like to wag our fingers at, frankly. Mm-hmm. So I think there are two levels. On the one level, we have to organize, I think, as journalists and as citizens of a democratic society and fight that kind of authoritarianism, because that's just wrong. It's anti-democratic. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, we've got to gain access today to a source. And so I try and sort of, I guess, speak with forked tongue, because on the one hand, you want to be really militant in fighting that kind of control at the top. But individually, when you are dealing with an agency at the state or local level, I preach civility. You've got to be kind. You've got to be polite. You have to be persistent. But there's no reason to get all antagonistic out of the gate. I think a lot of our student reporters want to be sort of Woodward and Bernstein starter kits, really, and go in guns a-blazing, and there might be a time for that. But when you're making your first request, that's not the time for that.
And Judd, this might be a good point to bring you in, because you've been on both sides of the fence here, right? You've been a journalist looking for information, but you also work for the Department of Natural Resources and were that agency that someone was trying to contact to get information. So what would you talk about the things we're hearing from Bob and Charles and how things are currently, how that process usually works on the side of the agency, I guess?
Well, I think Bob and Charles are both absolutely right. It is harder to get access now than it has been. And there's good reasons for it and there's bad reasons for it. I think Bob just looked down when I said there's good reasons for it, and I'm surprised he didn't kick me under the table. Charles, too. What makes good politics or good political policy doesn't always make good public information policy. And in a world where every government issuance and every government report and every political word is analyzed or spun or positioned or even taken into whatever context the taker wants to put it into, a more cautious approach is often felt to be better. Is that better for society at large? No, it's bad public information policy. Information should be out there. It should be free, particularly when the taxpayer is paying for that information. Is it a good, cautious policy? Absolutely. The epidemic that Bob refers to and that Charles has referred to is, in fact, writ large. It's not just the state of Missouri. I was speaking to an investigative reporter friend of mine who covers the environment in the Pacific Northwest. And the EPA up there won't allow any of their subject matter experts, any of their scientists, to sit down with a reporter unless there's a public information officer there, often restating the question like, well, what Wayne meant to say was and the days of Bob or other reporters being able to call up someone at their desk and say, tell me about this, are gone or are going away, not because of any one act, but because it's an effective policy. If you make a watertight seal where no information can come out, then scandals or friction points don't go very far because there's no one to comment on it.
I do want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today we're talking about hand transparent our state government really is. We're also talking about ways people access government records in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Bob Purdy, the news director of MissouriNet, based in Jefferson City, Judd Slivka, the former communications director of the Missouri Department of Natural Resources and a former journalist, and Charles Davis, a professor in the Missouri School of Journalism. His research is focused on access to government and media law. For you and our audience, what information would you like public officials to disclose? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. Okay, so Judd, I wanted to come back to you on that. So you mentioned trying to get these seal down the hatchets here, I guess. Mm-hmm. How did that work out when you were working with the Department of Natural Resources under the Nixon administration? How did that actually that structure, how was that put into place? What was that process like? Who made those calls and how did that work day to day, I guess?
Well, there was a policy, and the policy predated me getting there in November of 2009, that there would be one voice for the agency, and that voice for the agency would be whoever the communications director was. And that's how it worked. In some cases, there would be conversations with a reporter. A reporter would say, all right, I need this information. I would say, okay, well, let me go and get the information. And then I would come back and I would call Bob or one of his reporters back and I would say, here's what I have. And if there are more questions, I'd say, all right, well, let me go back. And I'd become this merchant going back and forth with questions and answers. Sometimes there would be the opportunity to do background where here's the information that you need to set it into context. And sometimes, and I think we're seeing this more, again, not just in the Nixon administration, but nationally, response by email. Send me your questions by email, and I'm going to respond by email, and that's it. You're going to get what I give you. And it's an effective policy. And I don't think that we have to go much further than looking at what happened in the Kansas City area with the Department of Social Services and the recent records requests and records issues of a child who was abused. It took months for those records to come out. And the hue and cry has been from not the public, but the media. We saw some editorials in the Kansas City Star. And so this is a strategy of being the carrier of information or of responding in ways that can't be responded back at that has been very successful.
So that's kind of a public be damned attitude, isn't it? It just because somebody wants some information and you decide you can drag it out as long as possible, the public isn't going to raise any cane about it, but the media will. This is a matter of government deciding that it's going to work for itself. The government's not supposed to be there to work for itself. I don't think our founders decided that was the way government is supposed to be intended, but that's the way government increasingly is becoming. We're here and we're working for ourselves, and the public be damned. And so we're not going to release information until we absolutely have to, and then we're going to dribble it out if we absolutely must. And therefore, we're going to make a big production out of it because we know that the reporters are the ones who are going to raise the cane, and the public really is pretty benign about this. The public doesn't get all excited about it unless it's in their own backyard. And so we're just going to kind of play hide-and-seek with you. And that, to me, as a journalist, and that, to me, as a citizen, is not what I expect my government to be when I ask some questions about significant issues.
And Bob and Charles, you both said it's gotten worse than it used to be. You put the time frame about 15 years, Bob. Is there any reason you can put or anything you can point to in that time frame, I guess, to explain why it's different now than it used to be?
I would put it at I think one of the most remarkable phenomenons in state and federal government at all levels is the rise of the public relations bureaucracy within state and federal agencies. Mm-hmm. That's not inherently a negative thing, mind you. I am just observing the natural phenomenon. When I was an active reporter, and Judd probably too, and Bob certainly knows the days when you had a couple of spokespeople, maybe an assistant to the communications director at an agency. Now it is not at all unheard of to have a dozen different public relations-oriented functionaries in an agency at the state level, and equally as many. I've lost count of the numbers in the city of Columbia. They're in the dozens. I don't think that's an exaggeration. And what that does, and I'm not impugning any evil intent on anybody, but it just adds layer after layer after layer of approval, obfuscation, delay. And that's not anybody being necessarily evil. It is just, you know, a Max Weber bureaucratic study in and of itself, where the bureaucracy is this self-consuming animal, and the request goes in to the maw of that bureaucracy, and 2 weeks later, it is still working its way through, not because anybody is sitting around sort of being, you know, necessarily evil. They're just doing their jobs, but there are so many of those jobs that are being done.
Yeah, and again, is there anything to point to as to why that bureaucracy has become more popular, I guess, or why it's something that has become a phenomenon now and wasn't before?
I think I can jump in a little bit.
Yeah.
The stakes are higher.
Yeah.
Power is more powerful and money talks more, and there's more to lose with missteps than there ever have been. I think that that's what it comes down to. We tend to protect the things that are the most important to us, whatever that is, and in a institution, in a bureaucracy, it's the power and the money. And so we tend to want to make sure that those things are protected and that the right messaging goes out and that the that policy imperatives aren't necessarily jeopardized by the slip of the tongue.
And so in the situations you've described, though, where it's kind of just a top-down, no matter what we're talking about, there's only one person, it doesn't really matter whether it's the thing that may make us look bad. It's just any information that anyone needs is just siphoned off or just completely blocked off, right? I mean,
I think oftentimes you see that, and certainly there are exceptions, but when you begin to treat one person in a special way, you end up having to treat everyone in a special way, and so it's easier to just treat no one in a special way.
Charles. Another part of this phenomenon at the federal level, I can't speak to the state with any certainty, but I know at the federal level, and this is a great untold story probably of the last 15 years, I guess, is that the first W. Bush White House began this phenomenon. The Obama administration has continued it in an unabated fashion, and that is inserting political appointees and political patronage positions further and further and further into the org charts of federal agencies. And that, when you talk about the stakes never being higher, they've really never been higher. If you take an agency like the EPA, there were people 3-4 rungs down the regional EPA org chart who were professional scientists, who were fairly dispassionate about the politics, were literally there to, you know, make sure the water was clean and the air was breathable. That's no longer the case. What you have now are politically minded scientists at many levels of the EPA going quite a ways down the org chart. That changes the entire dynamic of information policy because, again, it becomes about protection, political protection, more so than the dissemination of information. And that's been a really interesting – I keep waiting for the Washington Post or New York Times story where they can invest the resources and just looking at an org chart of an agency 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and today, and look at how many politicos are embedded in those agencies now. It's a phenomenal story.
And Bob, maybe I'd like to hear what your thoughts on Missouri, since again, Charles is talking more about the federal level.
Well, I think, first of all, you have two things going in Missouri. You have, first of all, the merit system agencies. So there's a merit system that presumably looks at how qualified people are to hold certain positions. But there are still plenty of patronage positions in the state government, especially in the executive branches of the office. So there are obviously people who are there because they are friends of whoever the office holder is. And some of them are in positions of some authority, and some of them are in positions of some action, and some of them are just there to get a paycheck. And filtering out who those people are is a pretty big discussion point. But I'm more interested in trying to find the people who are competent to answer my questions. And so a lot of times when I deal with an agency spokesman, my feeling is, well, don't they have anybody competent in the agency that can actually talk to me? And so that's the question that keeps coming up in my mind is, why build a stone wall to protect people who are competent? And that's one of the big problems that I face every time I run into someone who won't let me talk to somebody who is competent, and I have questions about whether they have anybody who is.
Well, and John, you kind of got to it earlier. When you had a question, you would go talk to someone who was competent, as Bob may say, who knew about this topic so that you could then be competent, on, so at least in some way, speaking about it. So what was the hesitation, or was there hesitation for you in letting that person talk? Or why – is it just that, like you said, a slip of the tongue is the risk there?
Or? You know, I think that someone – and it wasn't me – once said that having someone pick up the phone and talk to the press would be like putting someone out at the 50-yard line – of an MU football game and shouting with a megaphone to 75,000 people, and that there are consequences if they say the wrong thing. They might say the wrong thing. They might not say the wrong thing. To me, as an information officer who tried to straddle the line of this is what our policy is, and but we should help, the worry for me always was data outside of context. And I know that it's a bugaboo with Bob. I watched his head just sort of nod over there because I'm saying, well, we're reporters. We can find the context. Sometimes the context is there, and sometimes it's not. I remember as a reporter looking at a database of deficient dams back in the late 1990s and saying, oh, my God, all of these dams are deficient. They're all going to they're going to kill people. It's going to be another Johnstown flood. And then being able to talk to a dam engineer, and he said, no, it's a term of art, and while they're not good, they're not imminently going to fail. And so there's always, as an information officer, that worry that someone's not going to make that call back. But that does speak to Bob's point that people with expertise should be talking.
But when I called DNR and asked to a dam expert, that's speak to a dam expert. I got the spokesman for DNR.
Well, you talk to a dam.
No, but and so I guess – well, Bob, you did say that some agencies are better than others, though. I mean, sure. I guess, Judd, was that – maybe you guys can both help answer this. Was that something that came down directly from the administration? Was it a department-by-department decision? How does that work, and why might some be better than the others in Missouri?
I think that it is a topic – largely it's topic by topic. Some things people are more willing to talk to the press about than others, but I think Bob can probably speak more to it. Some of it's the culture of an agency. I think some of it is the nature of the issue.
Oh, absolutely true. I mean, we've had stories around here where it was completely, utterly in the agency's favor to do the story, to help with the story. And it was still just as difficult as if we were unearthing, you know, some cataclysmic scandal that was taking place. I mean, I've had several examples like that where you're literally on the phone with the spokesperson going, don't you understand? This is going to make you look good. You've reduced, you know, highway accident deaths in Missouri from X to Y over 10 years. Isn't that a story you want to tell? And I think a lot of it is just fear. In some of these agencies, people are scared to death. They don't even have – even if their title is communications director, they don't feel like they have the portfolio to step out and make calls without going, well, let me go run that through channels and get back. And everything is let me run that through channels and get back.
Let me give you an example of this a couple of years ago. The Conservation Commission has its monthly meetings, and every month they usually suspend somebody's hunting or fishing licenses for one reason or another. They're behind in their child payments, or they haven't paid their taxes, or so whatever. And so at the end of the year, they had their December meeting, as I recall it, and they sent out a list. These are the people who've lost their licenses. And I got to thinking, well, how many people have they suspended this year? So I called the Conservation Department, and I talked to somebody out there, and I said, how many people have lost their licenses this year? And I was told I would have to file a Freedom of Information request to get the information. Now, if I wanted to and I had kept the information from each monthly meeting, I could have just added it up myself. But in order to get a number and the reasons why, I would have had to file an FOI request. Now, you talk about something that's just absolutely stupid. And so I filed one, but it was a rather lengthy one. And I kind of indicated that I thought this was unforgivably dumb. And I got my information. And so, but that's the kind of hoops that you go through when you have to deal with this kind of mentality.
And I think I want to talk about the Freedom of Information Act maybe at the second half hour. I don't think I have enough time to get to it. We've just got a few minutes before the break. But I guess one of the things, we've talked about this a little bit too, but Charles, you kind of hit on the fact that there's a lot of people that work at these agencies in public relations that I guess I wonder, on an individual basis, we've already seen a little bit of it between you two, Judd and Bob, even though you haven't worked, I guess, with each other for a while since you haven't been at DNR. But what is the actual functioning relationship like between journalists and these spokespeople at different agencies? How does that work? What's in the way in this relationship if both of you are just trying to do your jobs?
Well, I'm not sure what their job is. When I call over there and I'm told that, well, you can't talk to the person you want to talk to, I start thinking, is part of their job hiding something? Is part of their job to obscure the information or control the information? I'm pretty confident that the whole thing, and Judd touched on this, the whole thing is about control of information. And I have a real problem with this kind of institutional control information business that I think has deepened in the last several years.
I don't think Bob's wrong. The role of the public information officer at the executive level, so the communications director, has shifted from what it may have been 15 or 20 years ago, and it shifted into a strategic communications position. Now, that strategic communications area, though, is a very it's a tenuous place in public information, because there's a tension between I'm protecting the interests of this agency or of this institution, which as a strategic communicator, that's what your role is, but I'm also paid by the taxpayers, and this is taxpayer information, and the taxpayers are entitled to this unless it falls under one of the exemptions for what we can't talk about, national security or confidential business information. And so there's a built-in tension there at the executive level of communications between protection and revelation. And I think that every time you get a call from a reporter, as a communications director, you do have to resolve that tension.
But, you know, one of the things that's most aggravating is that almost very seldom do I call up a state agency and want to ask any kind of questions that people think they need to protect themselves from me for getting. That's what's so aggravating about all of this, is most of these questions are fairly benign. They're basic information. There's no attack or no investigation that's going on here. And all of a sudden, people are in a bunker mode because it's Bob Priddy on the telephone.
Well, I guess, Judd, I mean, it may come back to the thing you mentioned earlier, that you don't know if a reporter's going to be able to provide that context. Is that the concern, or is it something else?
I think that's often the concern. I think that there's also just a protectionist attitude. No one remembers the 1,000 times that you do something right. They remember the one time you do something wrong, and I think that some of that contributes to the attitude as well.
My take on it is that government public relations, government communications has become corporate communications. The difference is that government is not corporate. Bob alluded to it earlier. We last I checked, operate a democratic republic around here. They're supposed to work for us, not vice versa. This is not Citibank. But the tactics nowadays at the government level, I think, mirror corporate public relations. And therein lies the disconnect, I think. You're right, Judd, it is a tension. But I think it's become an unnecessary tension at this point, because they've kind of forgotten on the government side of the ball that they do ultimately serve us at our pleasure. The public, meanwhile, doesn't seem to care enough to get upset enough to exert any political will over the situation. I mean, we're seeing some of that in Washington right now. People are pretty upset with the Obama administration over, of all things, the need for a federal shield law and subpoenaing journalists, which until this year, no one ever had cared about one whit outside of journalistic circles. So that's kind of an interesting phenomenon.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this half hour. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about how transparent our state government really is. We're also talking about the ways people access government records in Missouri and beyond. We'll be right back after a break. Hello and welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today on the show we're talking about how transparent our state government really is. We're also talking about ways people access government records in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Bob Priddy, the news director of the Missouri Net based in Jefferson City, Judd Slivka, the former communications director of the Missouri Department of Natural Resources and a former journalist, and Charles Davis, a professor in the Missouri School of Journalism. His research is focused on access to government and media law. For you and our audience, how could government be more transparent? Share your ideas. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you could join our online chat. Okay, one thing we mentioned earlier, and I think this is a good time to get to it, is Freedom of Information Act requests, and here in Missouri, Sunshine Law requests. Charles, this is something that you've done a ton of research and work on. I wonder if you could tell us, just first off, what's the difference between a Freedom of Information Act request and a Sunshine request? What are these things for people in our audience who don't know?
Simple nomenclature. The state calls its law the Sunshine Law. The feds call it the Federal Freedom of Information Act, or the acronym FOIA, which is usually used for it. Awkward acronym, but it's kind of become the term of art at that level. So long story short, you've got federal information law and you've got state information law. The state Freedom of Information Law, called the Sunshine Law, goes all the way down to local governance. Okay, so the Columbia School Board, Columbia City Council are as subject to those laws as Missouri state agencies are subject to those laws.
Okay. And so how do those requests usually go? What type of information are journalists usually looking for? Or anyone can make these requests. What are they looking for, and what can people get?
It depends. You can get a broad variety of records from agencies across the state, everything from some correspondence, budgets, inspection reports, audits. There's a rich, rich trove of information. Now, of course, Missouri state agencies are, to their credit, getting much better at proactively disclosing information. Information that they know is subject to the law already is going up online. And so there's a tremendous amount of information that already exists on Missouri state agency websites. And I would encourage anyone, I always do, when people call and say, I'm looking for X, Y, or Z, the first response is always, have you looked online to see if it's already there before you pester people with FOI requests? Because they are meddlesome and annoying. I acknowledge that at the forefront. That having been said, step two, ask for it interpersonally, kindly, politely. My students, I always have to walk them down because they want to paper people with formal requests under the Missouri Sunshine Law when they haven't asked for the information yet. I think that's bad protocol. I think it's offensive, frankly, particularly to, I don't know, the property tax assessor of Boone County, a guy who works awfully hard with very little staff. And I have one of my reporters go in and literally whip out a piece of paper and hoist it at him and say, this is a request under the Sunshine Law, when they haven't even had a phone conversation. That's tacky. So the first thing I want my students to do is just ask. And then finally, if they get met with, we either don't have that or you'll have to sunshine us, which is a frequent response. There are agencies at the local and state level that just as a matter of protocol say, we want the paper on this, so go ahead and sunshine me on it, and then I'll get in touch with you. That's fine. But you've done your homework at that point.
It's a little different than what we were talking about in the first half hour, because we're talking about hard data. We're talking about maybe email communications, things like that, that are publicly available documents, not necessarily, as Bob was talking about earlier, just trying to talk to someone at one of these agencies.
And this is a legal process. I mean, earlier we were having a conversation about schmoozing, largely, about working for access informally using human sources. Now we are talking about a paper-driven, process-oriented law that has exemptions and definitions, and it gets hyper legal pretty fast. But what I like to tell people is anybody can use this law, anybody, and people do. Citizens across the state use it every day.
And I wonder, Bob and Judd, maybe your experiences with these types of requests and how things usually go compared to how they're supposed to go. I guess
I haven't used an FOI request very often because in my line of work, I'm working on radio news is less investigative and more day-to-day, hour-by-hour, spot news, if you will. So we don't get into a whole lot of investigative stuff that requires us to go into FOI requests. Charles is right. There's an awful lot that's on the Internet. One of the prime examples, I think, is Missouri Ethics Commission's campaign finance reports, which are a gold mine in determining who is giving who how much money every year, and gives you pretty much an indication of, if you want to gauge a candidate on the basis of who they run with and who wants them elected, that will help you understand a little bit about who this person is counting on to provide the money. And that will tell you something about them and their campaign and what their office holding might be. So that's one of the more valuable things. But he's right. There's an awful lot on the Internet that one can get. We haven't had a chance or had a need to prowl around an FOI request very often.
Right. And Charles, I guess, how often do journalists use these? How often is it a tool in a regular newsroom?
It depends on the journalist. As Bob said, when you're doing breaking stuff, doing radio news, for example, you just don't have the time for the turnaround, and you don't generally have the need because you're not doing that more long-term investigative stuff. People use it every day, though, and a lot of daily beat reporters use it as part of their beat because sometimes when agencies are just being recalcitrant, you've got to use it sort of as a muscle to move them. Oh, by the way, a plug, shameless plug, our very own David Herzog here at the School of Journalism, who works at a shop called the National Institute for Computer-Assisted Reporting, has a website up called openmissouri.org. What David has done with the help of some graduate students is go to every state agency in the state of Missouri and effectively do an inventory of all the data that they have online. It's a fabulous service, and I can't recommend it highly enough. And it has automated FOI request form letters, and it's just a one-stop shop for FOI in the state of Missouri. Very handy.
Well, and I guess, Charles, too, I guess if you could talk a little bit about how that process is supposed to go and how it usually goes as well, because I've personally, as a journalist, have had to do some FOIA requests as well, and what we're supposed to get a response within 3 days, and then this information, I guess, if you could talk a little bit about how these things usually go.
Usually they go as follows. You make a request. It's ignored seemingly endlessly. You prompt the FOI officer in the agency. And by the way, this is not typically in the case of judge experience. I would imagine you were not the FOIA respondent. There's usually a custodian of records who more often than not is counsel as well. Increasingly, those are lawyers / FOI officers. They ignore you until you finally bug them enough that they finally get back with you, depending on who you are and what your request is, right? If you're Mike McGraw over at the Kansas City Star and you're making a request of the State Department of Transportation, they're going to get back with Mike really, really quickly because they are petrified of why he is sniffing around them. If it's a student at the Missouri School of Journalism, they might wait a couple of weeks. So there's a lot of variables going on here. And then you're going to get a response to your request. Either the agency is going to claim that some or all of that information is not subject to disclosure because of certain legal exemptions in the law. Okay, so there are 21, 22 exemptions under Missouri Sunshine Law to keep it in local. If your request has something to do with personnel, for example, then they're going to cite the personnel exemption under Missouri law that says we don't have to release information that has to do with the hiring, firing, disciplining, or promoting of individually identifiable personnel. They're going to cite that back at you and say, we can't give you this because of this. Any information that is not covered by an exemption, they're legally compelled to give you. That said, the next variable that comes in is price. So they're going to come back at you and go, we'd be happy to give you this information. It's going to take 30 man hours to compile, and that will cost you $350. And then you take a deep breath and try and figure out what to do from there.
Right. And it's kind of a negotiation, I guess, at that point.
It's like buying a used car.
But, you know, so many of the exemptions that are in the open meetings law and open records law are not shall, but are may exemptions. You may.
Sure.
And that doesn't mean – that didn't give you carte blanche to withhold. But most agencies do take the idea and say, oh, well, I don't have to. The law doesn't allow me to do this. And they forget about it. May.
And this
you
is
may.
This is where you kind of get hyper-legal because a lot of those exemptions were purposefully broadly written. The courts have given meaning to those exemptions over the years. So in some cases, you have to do a little shade tree lawyering and figure out what the legal work product exemption actually means, for example. And that gets – that's where you have to really sort of do some research. It's doable. The Attorney General's website, excellent Sunshine Law section on the Attorney General's website that has all the judicial interpretations that are pretty significant of the Sunshine Law. So the do-it-yourself crowd can make this happen. I've done it countless times, so it can be done.
Yeah, one interesting exception, I guess. I don't know exactly how it works in legally, but is Missouri legislators aren't subject to having to provide emails and things like that. That's a pretty interesting one here in Missouri. It kind of varies state to state how that is. But like the governor's office, for instance, will have to provide emails, but the legislature may not. I'm guessing that's probably been kind of a hindrance in some of your work, Bob.
Well, from time to time, yes. You have various provisions in the state law that legislators don't have to obey some of the laws that the rest of us have to obey, especially during the legislative session. Now, that's why you can see a legislator with an R or an S on their license plate go sailing past you at 90 miles an hour. They're not going to get arrested, but you will if you try to keep up.
There's a really fancy legal term for that called hypocrisy.
Well, one other topic that we wanted to get to, because it's kind of relevant at the moment, the Bradley Manning case is starting today. And that had to do with a leak at the federal level. And Charles, maybe you can help us a little bit on this as well. But for these leaks and information that does come out of these agencies, what kind of protections are there legally for the people that are leaking? Again, we have Bradley Manning with an Army sergeant who's on trial at the moment. But what are some protections for different agencies at the government level for these whistleblowers, as you would call
them? And if we were going to ask Specialist Manning, I think his answer would be none whatsoever, right? Very, very few. There are federal protections in place for the act of whistleblowing in terms of its reprisal by the agency. Okay, we got to differentiate that from Department of Justice investigations of leaks. Those are very different. So you might, for example, I have somebody I've come in contact with through the years who was the former chief of the U.S. Park Police. She was newly named right before September 11th. In the wake of September 11th, she gave an interview to the Washington Post. Her name's Teresa Chambers, by the way. Look her up. It's an amazing story. She gave an interview to the Washington Post about protecting America's treasured monuments in the wake of the terrorist attacks. And she said in the course of this very, very, very public interview, we're down people and we're down dollars. Our budgets have been cut. I think we're going to have to be restored to our former budgets in order to maintain the protection we're going to need. She was dismissed within days for those comments. And the administration never even couched it in any other terms. They said, you spoke to the media, you talked about your budget, we're letting you go. It took her 8 years to be vindicated. You think about whistleblowing, you think about people meeting in parking garages and whispering into one another's ears. This is a woman who gave an interview to the Washington Post on the record and was fired for her speech. So when we say there are protections in place for whistleblowers, you got to take that in context because it takes them years and many of them never are vindicated. The Obama administration now is the most active leak investigating White House in the history of the United States. So these are not good times for whistleblowing, to say the least. And Manning is kind of emblematic at a very high level of that.
And the case the government would make in this situation is that this information was had to do with safety of the people that were involved in the information, I guess, right? That this leak is going to put people's lives in danger. I guess what kind of reaction do you have to that sentiment? And are there situations where that really is the case?
I'm sure there are. The government is yet to be able to point to a single instance in this case in which there is. It kind of reminds me of the Pentagon Papers case back in the 70s in which the federal government asserted that the release of classified information was going to do grave damage to the United States. The Supreme Court took a look at the information in the Pentagon Papers and said, the only damage that's being done to the United States here is PR damage. There are no agents in the field. This is a backward-looking document. It's history. Some of the Manning leak arguably could touch people in the field. arguably, but it is extraordinarily arguable. And if you go back to the Pentagon Papers case again, New York Times versus the United States, and read the language of the court, what the court said is there must be a grave danger of immediate, irreparable harm to national security interests. I don't think there's any way this reaches that standard.
You know, the Park Service lady probably would have kept her job if a spokesman would have done the interview.
It's true.
Thanks for bringing us
back.
Don't
say that.
Well, to Bob's point, though, and I think to Charles's as well, you talked before about you don't want someone's comments jeopardizing a policy imperative, and rightly or wrongly, I tend to think she was in the right on this one, but. What her comments did was they jeopardized a policy imperative about national security and created a parallel narrative, or had the potential to create a parallel narrative to what the administration wanted at that time. And that's why agencies and administrations like to have those checks and balances in place.
Right. And I guess – but though, again, this was kind of an individual decision, right? That's probably difficult for the individual in that position to know where the line is, or is it clear where the line is?
I think that that really depends on the administration, and it depends on the messages that go up and down through the chain of command. I'm not as familiar with the case as Charles might
sure,
be,
sure,
but
sure.
You know, there may very well have been a directive of don't say anything that changes this narrative, or don't talk to anyone, don't talk about numbers, don't talk about staffing, because that's not an uncommon thing. Again, not just at the state level, at the federal level, for that directive to come down. Talk about X, don't talk about X1, X2, X3, because they can change the conversation and you don't want to do that.
One thing that we've found through the years is that if we can't get through to somebody to talk to them on an issue, sooner or later they have to come out in the daylight. Department directors have to testify before appropriations committees, and in the hallway they're red meat for reporters who haven't been able to talk to them in the past. Or they're someplace for a ribbon cutting or someplace for a formal announcement of some kind. And we have a tendency not to pay any attention to the formal staged event. But as soon as they step off the platform, boom, the reporters are right around them. And that's you sometimes have to wait to catch them in situations like that.
Well, the thing is, when this crackdown on whistleblowing at the federal level – and the leak investigations and all that. What does it do practically from a policy standpoint? You could argue it scares people to death and they go into hiding and they don't talk about fraud, abuse, corruption, things that are taking place on the ground that we need to know about as a people. And I think that's a powerful argument. I also think it's a little too simple of an argument, because I think what actually happens is twofold. Some people get scared and don't talk about fraud, abuse, and corruption. Some people get more emboldened and angered by the actions of higher federal officials and start talking more. I mean, I've seen it happen over and over and over and over again. Maybe the best example, Dana Priest of the Washington Post did this story a few years ago about Walter Reed Army Hospital. You may remember it, in which she won a Pulitzer for an investigation of the unbelievably bad conditions in that hospital. That happened – as she relayed the story to me, because an orderly, and they had this blanket order, do not talk, do not talk. And she's walking down the hall on this VIP tour that they set up, which was just whitewash. All the rooms look like, Hilton hotel rooms. And an orderly walked by and kind of whispered to her and said, you should go down that other wing. And she did. So sometimes these ideas of sort of authoritarian control at the top just blow up.
All right. I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today on the show we're talking about how transparent our state government really is. We're also talking about ways people access government records in Missouri and beyond. Joining me in studio are Bob Priddy, the news director of MissouriNet, based in Jefferson City, Judd Slivka, the former communications director of the Missouri Department of Natural Resources and a former journalist, and Charles Davis, a professor in the Missouri School of Journalism. His research is focused on access to government and media law. And for you and our audience, should there be greater transparency with campaign financing? What would you like to see? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at IntersectKBIA. One thing we haven't really talked about that I wonder, because you've mentioned this, Bob, you mentioned, and we kind of talked about this 10 or 15 year timeline where things have seemed to change here in Missouri. I wonder about if the digital age has changed that at all. Maybe Judd, it might be good to start with you talking about how the digital age affected decisions you made when you were at DNR, whether it's social media, Twitter, Facebook, where things are going to end up and how quickly information can be spread now.
I think that largely, it's been a good thing in terms of getting records online, both from projects like Dave Herzog's, but also at on the state's own data.mo.gov, and then on the state agency sites where you're seeing more information going out there. The risk, of course, is it's information without context, and then that requires a reporter to call, and well, you sort of end up in the cul-de-sac of what happens when you call an agency. Social media, I think, is a chapter that we still haven't seen how it ends in terms of agency communications. There's a lot of agencies that are out there tweeting actively, Facebooking. I saw a federal agency on Pinterest the other day, which was a first and not a little bit disturbing. But the potential for saying the wrong thing or saying something that offends a vocal minority is much greater on social media. And the social media shops in state agencies and in federal agencies tend to be run by the public information folks. And so there's yet another clash of cultures there between this open, fast, loose social media culture that we see developing and the conservative institutional public information culture.
Social media, though, allows an agency, a candidate, whomever, to simply bypass the press entirely. They're able to go out and they're able to directly contact large numbers of the American public without any accountability, without any responsibility for what they say or what they allege or what they claim. And so the kind of inspection that you would get from a reporter when you make a comment like that can be completely ignored because you're going directly to the public. And frankly, I think that is a grave danger.
Oh, you could devote an entire show to what not only social media but digital media have done to the landscape. I mean, the most fundamental thing they've done to the landscape is the wrenching transition from traditional news media to digital news media have cost us so many boots on the ground. There are just so many fewer reporters than there were. So that's the most obvious one. Things happen across the government at the state, local, federal level that there's just nobody there to see because there aren't as many warm bodies as there were. And that's a tragedy in and of itself. And then you've got speed as well, which I'm sure Judd lived with all the time, which is I find that my students, even as it gets more difficult, they want answers immediately to everything. And sometimes I kind of have to walk them down and go, you know, they do have other people to deal with other than you because they expect to just text and get a text message back with an answer to a question.
Well, and so then what do journalists need to do to remain relevant? If you can just take – if agencies can just take their message straight to anybody out there in the world that wants it or that they want to have it, what do journalists do to remain relevant?
Well, we also use social media. And we can attempt to bring these people into some form of accountability, whether we have to lurk in a hallway and catch them when they come out of their office or come out of a hearing, or whether we have to work through somebody like Judd and hope that we can get through to them and ask them some questions about this stuff that they're putting out there. But we also can use social media. We also not only use social media, but we use the contemporary standard media, too, to make corrections or challenge or to report on the shortcomings of the statements that people are making. And frankly, sometimes it works to raise doubts about the truthfulness of what is being circulated by those who want to avoid people like me.
I don't know. I guess, Charles, yeah, back to the idea of how it's changed, though, that access to government, I guess. How it's, you know, is there just a fear that things are going to, if a reporter does a story, it's going to all of a sudden be everywhere in the world. It's not going to just be a local rag anymore that's doing this story. It's going to all of a sudden be anything you say to any agency or to any news agency can be a big deal today, and maybe that wasn't the case 15 years ago.
I mean, I don't know if it hadn't always been the case, but it's more the case.
Sure.
Not only that, but I mean, in all fairness, these people are pretty besieged these days. You've got not only the traditional news media, but now you've got hyperpartisan blogs left, right, and center. You've got citizen activist groups that are making requests. So I do think in terms of sort of arguing the alternative, that there are more people asking for more from government than ever before.
I think we don't have to look too far for an example, right? Todd Akin was on a local talk show in St. Louis, and all of a sudden everywhere and everyone in the country knew what he said, and it made a huge impact on his race. And so, Judd, it kind of gets to what you were talking about earlier. The stakes are really high now.
The stakes are high, and the opportunity to offend people in a medium in which taking offense is okay and giving voice to that offense is even better is there. I think back to a few years ago when the Corps of Engineers activated the Birds Point New Madrid floodway.
Oh, yeah.
And two state parks were inundated with floodwaters. And one of the state parks or state historic sites was Talasaga State Historic Site, which has a number of Native American burial mounds. And animals are pretty smart. They run to the top of the mounds, and that's where they hang out. And we put a picture on the Facebook page that a conservation helicopter pilot had taken while they were dropping food to the animals on top. And it showed, you know, three turkeys, two wolves, and eight deer. And the questions that we got in the comments on the page weren't, what a great picture, or I'm glad that they're up there. It's, what happened to the deer? Why haven't you airlifted the deer out? And it was question after question about, what about the poor deer? What about the poor deer? What about the poor deer? And we just sat there going, what about the park? No, it's about the deer. And there was this whole it became a minor thing about, what about the deer? Because it was something that people wouldn't have seen, but it hit a wider audience. It moved semi-virally in sort of a sluggish viral way. And then it allowed people the opportunity to comment on or be impressed or offended at something and then give voice to that in a way in which other people could see it.
We only have a couple minutes left in the show, and I thought it'd be a good time to just pitch one quick question to all of you to answer real briefly. It's just, we've talked a lot about how things don't really work between the two sides. What advice would you give to someone trying to make it work as a journalist or as a public relations person? What advice would you give to try to make it work and navigate how things are now?
Well, I'd certainly say that when you call the PR person, you have something specific in mind that you want to ask, that you're not just on a fishing expedition, and that you say, look, I need to talk to so-and-so about this. And sometimes they'll say, well, can you submit, as was noted, can you submit your questions by email? And the answer is always, heck no, because I never know what I'm going to ask these people. I might ask one question that would be on my list, but that person's answer might take me somewhere else. So that's impossible to do. But you can let them know that you're not there with a hatchet. You're looking for some clarification, some context, and that, I think, helps or should help open the gates.
I agree. I think it's, you know, you get more flies with honey than you do vinegar. And I think, you know, it always helps when there's an acknowledgement that it's a person, not just a policy that you're pushing against. And to be nice, say, hey, look, I know this is hard, but can you help me? I have these specific questions. And then on the other side, it would be just be willing to negotiate down. I have these specific questions. You can't answer them in this way. Can you answer them in this way?
Charles,
don't always take the easiest route either. Go talk to the people who are doing the science on the ground. Don't use them as official sources. Just go learn from them. You'll find out a tremendous amount more about an agency if you flip the org chart and don't talk to the spokespeople, but talk to the people that are doing the work.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Intersection. We'd like to thank our guests, Bob Priddy, Charles Davis, and Judd Slivka. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection's a rebroadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection's produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangware. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike McKean and Mike Dunn. I'm Ryan Mueliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.